Hello and welcome to the At YouTube podcast, episode number 50, a podcast where we talk all things YouTube, featuring the staff of atu2.com. I'm your host, Chris Enns, and for this special EP episode, we've got an interview that Matt McGee and myself did with Andy Green from Rolling Stone. Andy had recently interviewed The Edge, Adam Clayton, and Willie Williams about U2's upcoming Joshua Tree tour, and so we picked his brain about what songs he thinks they'll play, the promotional method for a unique tour like this, fun stories he's had interviewing the band over the years, including a really fun tale of actually ditching the band to go see the tour instead of interviewing the band when he had the chance. Well, I should mention that in the spirit of Rolling Stone and rock and roll, there's a couple of S-bombs that slipped through the censor meter. Hope you enjoy the interview. We'll see you again on the next episode, where we'll continue our album-by-album series looking at Songs of Innocence. First of all, welcome to the At YouTube podcast, and it's very good to have you on the show. And I know there's lots of YouTube fans who've read your recent interviews and articles with band members and Willie Williams and stuff, and are excited to sort of hear, interested to hear what your insider look into the mechanisms and the machinations of U2 is. But by way of sort of going back a little bit, I'm just curious, where and how did you first discover U2, the band?
Yeah, I discovered them a bit late in life for a rock fan, I guess. I always knew about them. The thing that first struck me was the VMAs in 97 when they played Please.
Oh, nice.
So I came in, so it's weird. It was kind of during Pop Mart, which was, I know, not their high point of their commercial career. But I guess with Octoon Baby, I was 10 years old. So I think it was kind of the first album where I was really buying new albums. And I heard Please live, and it sort of blew me away. And I went out and bought Pop, and I loved it. I mean, it remains one of my favorite U2 albums. I have a poster of it.
That was one of our follow-up questions. What is your favorite U2 album? So,
you know, it's hard to separate ones that you like when you were young. I love Octoon Baby. I love Zeropa. I love War. But there's something about Pop. And even though it has some of their worst songs, that the Playboy Mansion has aged horribly, and whatnot, and I don't like Miami all that much, and Staring at the Sun was better live. I still am really fond of it. I think Gone is my favorite U2 song, maybe. I love Discotheque. So I might be a contrarian and say Pop.
I don't know, Andy, we do this big online fan survey every few years, and Pop, yeah. It's never the, like, Octoon Baby and Joshua Tree are the obvious, you know, favorite,
right.
But Pop is always number one as most underrated album. There's a legion of fans that are very vocal about Pop, and they want U2 to play more Pop songs live in concert. So you're not alone by any means.
Yeah, there's just something about it. And the fact that they don't love it and that Larry didn't like it, it's almost like this forbidden thing that you're not supposed to like, which makes it more attractive. And they keep remixing it. And it just sort of, I don't know, there's something about it that's always appealed to me. I was going to say, yeah, so I got way into Pop, and then, God, I got a CD bootleg of the Pittsburgh Pop Mart show, this awful-sounding thing.
Oh,
but that was,
gosh,
the first place I'd heard a lot of the older songs, was on this awful CD bootleg that was like $45 in my record store. And I was super bummed that I missed Pop Mart, but that got me way into it. And then, God, you know, the sweetest thing happened. I didn't see them live. I was a freshman in college when they put out Elevation. I guess it's called All You Can't Leave Behind. And I got really amped up. I was in the fan club, and I bought tickets to like 9 shows. And I flew to Miami and saw the tour opener.
Nice.
And, yeah, I mean, I was 18 or whatever, and blew my mind away. And then I saw 4 straight shows during finals week my freshman year. I drove to Pittsburgh. I was in line all day. I got in the heart. Then we did Cleveland before that. We did Columbus. We did Kentucky. I was in Chicago for the 3rd and 4th night when they did Out of Control and like TikTok again. I went crazy. So that really got me. I became a super, super fan, I'd say, in 2001 on the Elevation tour. I just kept going to more and more shows.
That was a great tour.
Yeah, no, it was super exciting, and they were back. I mean, it was finally the thing I liked, because I was so into them in, like, 99 or whatever, you know, when they weren't even around.
Did you see any of the shows post 9/11 at Madison Square Garden?
It killed me. I was at Kenyon College. I was in Gambier, Ohio. I had a car. We almost drove to Canada to see one of them. It was on a Saturday, but the timing was just awful. So no, I didn't see any shows there after that. I would have loved to, because they started playing Please again.
Yeah.
And that's the number one song I love to hear is Please. At least once they play. So no, I didn't see him again until the Brooklyn show in By the Bridge they did in 2004.
So by way of throwing a little plug in, you should, is there an Andy account on tours.atu2.com where you tracked your U2 concerts that you've been to?
What? Yeah. I think I did fill out a form where I can see all my shows. So yeah.
Okay. There you go. Perfect. I was going to say, we're going to have to give him a link if he doesn't have it that way. So Andy, your U2 fan card is well established here.
Yes.
Right. I mean, this is not like you're just not dabbling.
I have the CD bootlegs. I bought them. You know, I wanted the Fortunate Son cover, which is the worst thing I've ever done. I have Happiness is a Warm Gun on CD. I have all that shit. I have a lot of 80s bootlegs. I can talk about Self-Aid. And when they played My Hometown, you know, I can get, and when I can get into real minutia shit, I'm way into
it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's, well, like I'll just repeat this for listeners, because I was telling Chris this when you, Andy and I first chatted the day after the band crashed our party. And I think, Andy, you might have like reached out to me on Twitter or somewhere and said, you know, can we talk? I want to, you know, do a story on them showing up at the party, blah, blah. And so I was like, you know, yeah, like, cool, it's Rolling Stone. But I'm like, you know, does this guy understand how big a deal it is and all this sort of stuff? And then we talked and I was like, oh, my God, Andy is like a total fan. He's like the, you know, as big a U2 nerd as anyone. So it's really cool that you're. And so we, you know, the fan reaction, I assume you got a lot of tweets over the last. Couple weeks? The edge piece went out what, 2-3 weeks or so ago, and then Adam and Willie were more recently. And I mean, you had to be getting a lot of tweets from fans just really enjoying the questions you asked.
Yeah, I can think of very few articles I've ever done that have gotten more fan thank you tweets than those. You know, I've been on staff for 13 years. I've done a lot of articles, but. I think there's such a huge U2 cult. I think a lot of people, they don't realize not only are U2, like, they're one of the biggest bands in the world, they have one of the biggest cult audiences in the world, too. It's sort of rare there's a band that both has huge mainstream appeal and a huge cult. You know, there are huge groups like the Stones or something, but there's not a huge, like, web following of Stones fans. You know, it's not the same thing. So, yeah, it was very nice to get so much feedback for just 3 interviews. Yeah.
Is there anything that didn't get included in the online pieces that you're allowed to share? Anything that, like, an editor chopped out because they thought it was too nerdy or anything like that?
No, I mean, in the print story, it was chopped down a lot. But for the online, I used every single word. I don't think I took out. I mean, I guess at the very beginning, I was talking to Edge A about the weather and whatnot. But besides that, I tried to really get most every word in. I'm a firm believer in an online, you know, if you're talking to somebody big and you have as much room as you want on the web, to just go long. So even when they're rambling about something, I kept it all in. It was hard, was I knew about this tour like 2 months before they announced it, so it was really painful to just walk around knowing that and not being able to talk about it.
And I should also mention, Just to, in case anybody gets suspicious, we on At You Too, we reported several of the rumors of the tour, like in the 2 weeks before the announcement, and I think we nailed everything we reported. And in case anyone is wondering, I just want to confirm that Andy is not our source on those rumors.
I told nobody, but I will give the backstory. It was their publicist that came into our office. At least 2 months before the announcement, possibly 2.5 months, or something crazy. And we're casually talking to them all off the record about next year, and they're going through all their bands and these new albums, and they just casually say, "Oh yeah, and U2 are doing a tour that's for the Joshua Tree." And I was like, "Wait, what?" And they go, "Yeah, they're playing it straight through." And I was like, "Wait, what?" I was like, "What? Say it again." And they said, "Yeah, it's a U2 tour for the Joshua Tree. They're going to play it straight through. They're playing stadiums." And I tried to just stay calm, but in my mind, I'm like, "Oh my God, you know. And it was like Halloween or something. I don't know. It was forever ago. So it was agony to walk around with that, knowing people were just going to flip their shit. Because then I Googled it and I searched on Twitter and there was nothing. So I was like, God, like, no one knows this. So it was really difficult to not tell anybody that for so long.
It's like torture, I would assume.
It was torture because, you know, I read the forums. I've been on at YouTube 10 billion times. I went on there in high school, you know, so I know the fan community wants to know it, but, you know, I couldn't reveal it. So, and then I spoke to Edge a few weeks before the announcement. So I talked to him about it. I had to sit on that for a long time. You know, it was not fun.
The public doesn't know the torture of being a journalist, right?
Yeah, you know, when you make a deal, you make a deal, and if you break that deal, you know, you're...
Oh, yeah, you're out then. You're just...
Banned. Yeah, so, and you can't, you know, you can, and you can't do that. So it was very nice to finally post it. When it goes out that second on Twitter and you just watch the traffic spike, it's like, oh, finally, you know, people can know about it.
That's awesome. So, yeah. So you as a fan, you were, you know, just a wee little kid in 1987. So are you excited to see this?
Oh, I can't wait. I'm super, super psyched. I love Exit. It's a song I've been dying to hear live just forever. Yeah, I mean, I love you too. My frustration with their concerts has always been, it's always the new album and the biggest hits. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for much else. So this is finally, you're guaranteed all six or seven of the songs that they're on to play.
In the interview with Willie, you mentioned, quoting him, you said, so many reviews will have a little go by saying, did they have to play so much of the new record?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously as a U2 fan, you're partial to them or whatever you might be, but as someone who reviews a lot of live music in general, just through your writing and your work, how good a job do you think U2 does at balancing that, like, new, old? Because fans sort of feel like, well, I guess it depends on the fan, right? Some fans think, why isn't there more old stuff? Why is all the new stuff? And vice versa, I guess. But how do you?
I'm fine with hearing, like, most of the new album. I want to hear that. But I think they have too many must plays. I think they think, well, we got to play Pride and we got to play I Will Follow and we got to do With or Without You. And then when you get through that, there's not a lot of room. And that's why I was so excited for the last tour, the idea of the two nights. I was thrilled with that. I'm like, God, finally, I think that's brilliant, dude. Two different sets. And then I was bummed out that they killed that. I just think that they're, you know, as I discussed with Adam and Edge, that they're in an impossible situation. Most of the audience just knows the hits. You know, I'd say maybe 75% of the people at an average show, they know 15 songs maybe. And if they don't hear it, they're pissed off. So it's hard to not cater to that.
I remember on the 360 tour, this is my favorite. Like, I would love, to, you know, I'm sure all three of us, we would love to hear these songs that are super rare, never get played, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm in that boat too, but, you know, for me, the, you know, going to a U2 concert, the audience vibe for me is almost as important as what the band is doing on stage there. Cause if you've got a dead audience or something like that, it really just, I think U2 senses that, and it sort of kind of, you know, there's sort of like a give and take there. And when the audience is great, the band gets better and vice versa. And I remember the 360 tour, I went to see both of the shows in New Giant Stadium, East Rutherford there. And that's when that was the fall tour, and they were playing Your Blue Room, right? Which
right,
nobody
yes.
knows, right? Nobody knows that song unless you are like this uber U2 fan. And the first night of the two shows, I was up in the seats, second level, with my son, and that song started. And, you know, so my son and I get really excited, and everyone around us in every section, like, you know, you can look two or three sections to each side of you, everyone either sits down or they leave to go to the bathroom or get food. My son and I were the only two people standing up, and it just drew the life and, you know, out of the show. I loved hearing it, but yeah, like, nobody else knows that stuff.
Yeah, and the band feels that. And when you can just watch the crowd just deflate and go to the bathrooms and get on their phones, it's hard to not to be bummed out about that. I mean, I've seen Mick Jagger always say that he hates playing to blank faces. you know, there's so much reward for playing Satisfaction or for playing Where Streets Have No Name. And there's so little reward for playing Refugee or something, you know, that it's just when you're playing stadiums or even arenas, it's tough. At the same time, I wish they would, you know, sprinkle in one a night or something on the B stage on the last tour, be a bit more adventurous. It was so fun when they played Trash Trampolina and the Party Girl out the garden. You know, just a few more sprinkles would be nice, but I understand that they really can't do a deep cut show or play a bunch more rarities.
Andy, didn't the Rolling Stones at some, I don't follow the Rolling Stones very closely, so I'm going to rely on you to know this.
Yeah.
Several years ago, didn't they have a tour where they would go to a city and they would do both a club show or maybe just an arena show and a stadium show? And like the little show was for the...
They billed it as that, the small, medium, and large tour. They said it would be like buying underwear or something. It comes in small, medium, and large. And they did it in Boston and New York and Chicago, maybe, but 90% of the tour was still like stadiums or playing arenas.
Was
and
it?
Even the club shows were full of hits.
I could see. I mean, that to me would be like one solution out of this problem is you announce your tour and say, all right, we're going to play the big venues and this is going to be, you know, we're going to play the hits and this and that sort of stuff. It's going to be, you know, a regular U2 show, but we're also going to do some of these smaller theaters, you know, 2,000 seats or whatever. And we're going to really dig in and do our rarities on these shows. So if you don't want to hear songs you've never heard, then don't come to this one. This is for the diehards. And to me, that always seemed like a logical potential way to handle that.
I would love that too. I just think the problem is if a band like U2 announces a show at a theater or a club, it's just pandemonium and tickets are being scalped for $5,000.
Yeah, that's true.
There's chaos outside and you've got to step in almost and sort of say that all tickets are going to be will call and then everybody's furious and the guest list demands are through the roof. It just becomes absolute hell and it almost becomes not worth it. I was going to say that when they played Irving Plaza in 2000, it was supposedly just a huge clusterfuck to get in and fans outside. And so many fans are so disappointed when they can't get in.
Yeah, you almost have to do like a week of air quotes club shows to appease all the fans who would still go to a club show. And never mind those who just see it as an event to be at, whether they love you too or not, just to see them up close, I guess, like that. So, but thank you from all the Acrobat and Drowning Man fans for asking about those rare songs that they haven't played.
Yeah, I've been dying to ask them about that stuff for years. I've had interviewed Edge a couple of times, but never where I could really just have time to talk to him finally. You know, I was backstage at opening night in Vancouver in 2015. I guess it was the day before the first concert, but I had 20 minutes. I had just 20 minutes with Bono and the Edge. And Bono just talks. So I'd ask one question. He just took off. I was marched backstage and they told me, look, it's a really tight schedule. They have CBS News here. There's an HBO crew here. You have 20 minutes to the second and we're going to enforce that. And I said, okay, great. You know, and I had two pages of the magazine to fill. So I walked into this room. I sit down with them and they're like, where are you from, Andy? And I go, I live in Brooklyn. And Bono goes, Andy Green from Brooklyn. His brother wanted to be a journalist, too. And he just starts spewing this whole fake story of my life. And he's laughing. But, like, meanwhile, the clock is ticking. I'm like, Sean, like, shut up, Bono. I want to ask a question. Stop this nonsense. Yeah. And, you know, it was really weird to just, my blood was boiling. I love him, but he just, you know, he filibusters. And he was sipping tea. He was so casual. But I'm like, Bono, I have 20 minutes. I have two pages to fill. I flew here from New York. I'm in freaking Vancouver. Just let me talk to you. So I had on my questions then. I was going to ask about Acrobat and Drowning Man then, but I asked three questions and Bono just filibustered. You know, I still got good stuff, but it wasn't
20 minutes and you got three questions?
Well, I'm exaggerating. I maybe got like three questions.
Okay.
What I learned eventually was they gave me a sign of 2 minutes left. And I'm like, oh, shit, I have so much to get to. So I just turned towards the Edge. I looked him in the eye, and I did the rest of the interview straight to the Edge. I just totally ignored Bono because I knew Edge would be more concise. So it was really funny. I was forced to just pretend Bono, like, didn't exist and only interview the Edge because otherwise I was completely screwed.
That's one of the questions I actually had for you is in this process of, like, you know, you're talking to Willie Williams, Adam, and the Edge. Do you, is that a request for you through the publicist, or do they just say, trot out, okay, Adam's going to talk to you, Willie will talk to you, or, you know, is there, what's the process?
Well, we asked for everybody. The first thing we said was, who can talk? You know, we would like Bono and The Edge. And they said, great, The Edge is going to call you, like, tomorrow. And I go, great, you know. So I interview Edge, then we're like, okay, well, we're going to post that on the website on the day of the announcement, but the issue is going to be out for 2.5 weeks. So by the time of the issue, we would love more than just what's online, so we'd like somebody else. And they go, great, Adam will call you in a week. And I go, awesome. And then we asked for Bono. They said that he wasn't available. And they said, is there anybody else not in the band? And I was thinking Guy O'Siri, but I've talked to him before. So I asked for Willie, and they said, great. And then, you know, I think I figured 3 interviews was sufficient for a story. It was in the rock section.
Oh, maybe with Willie's interview, just one other thing I kind of smiled at, just in light of that, I guess the where he says, let me just pull it up here quickly. You said, I'm looking at a seating chart right now. Is the B stage in the shape of a tree? And then he kind of responds, is that commercially available? And like, as if he's not sure what he's supposed to say or not. And that must be a bit nerve. I'm sure Willie is very used to this by now, but like, you know, he doesn't want to spill beans that he's not supposed to, and kind of being a bit cagey, I would guess, in conversations, trying to make sure he's not revealing too much.
Yeah. No, yeah, that was definitely funny, because, you know, they're terrified to be the person that will leak something out. You know, they want to talk to you if they're told to, but they don't want to be the guy that says something that you shouldn't. But it was on Ticketmaster. It was in the shape of a tree. So that was pretty funny when we were talking about that, you know, because the stage is still somewhat of a secret, you know, which often is until opening night.
One of the things, Andy, and if you've been paying attention to the conversation on Twitter or forums and what have you, one of the things fans are talking about is, and you asked Adam about this, is this a legacy tour, right? You know, it's like, what is U2 doing? They've always been this forward-looking band. They've never, you know, gone back and celebrated, you know, an album like this. Where do you fall on the spectrum of that question?
Well, it's a difficult question. I mean, yes, it's a legacy tour. It's an anniversary tour. It's their biggest album. They're doing it straight through. It's selling like crazy because of that. But I think there's no one that doesn't do this stuff. That Bruce Springsteen just spent a year on the road for an album from 1980, you know, and Roger Waters, and like just everybody doing this. And if you look at where the Stones, about where they were at 40 years into their career, that was 2002 or whatever. You know, they've been a nostalgia band for 25 years at that point. So the fact that U2 went as long as they did not doing this is what's astounding to me. It's not astounding that they're doing it now. And I think it's a good way to sort of remind people why they're great and use it to sort of boost up the next album and next tour. So if they stayed in this zone, if they permanently moved to be a nostalgia band, if they became The Who or something where it's only about the past, then that's just surrendering. If it's a few months on the road and then right to the next album, it's sort of a readjustment and reboot. And I think following Songs of Innocence, that was probably a wise move. That the album's great, but it's hard to argue the launch of it went very well. And they were it was a dangerous period. You know, if the next album that came out and got almost no reception, you know, which is not impossible, they'd be in a bad spot. So instead, they're about to go on the biggest tour of the year. So it's definitely a legacy tour. But you can visit your legacy briefly, and that's fine, I think.
Yeah, the Adam lets out an agonized groan that's actually in the article too. I love just the extra little touch of detail that you wouldn't always get necessarily to your question about nostalgia and stuff like that. You mentioned it, and it's been writing too, the idea of playing the album full through. And do you get the sense that it actually will be a literal start to finish thing, or what's your sense from that?
I'm very stumped about that, because The Edge basically said that was going to happen. though he kind of danced around it. And Adam was very unsure, and Willie had ideas that he wouldn't share with me. So I just think they're in a sort of a pickle that the album is very front-loaded as far as hits. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, four songs they play at every show, basically. And then you have, what, seven straight? Most people don't know. I think at a stadium, that could be a problem. And even there's still Joshua Tree songs. I think a lot of people who are going to show up will know zero of those songs. I think at least half the audience will not be familiar with those songs. And so
I guess don't you think they'll be familiar with them, though, because everybody has the album, right?
Yeah, I think the counter argument might be that Roger Waters' Wall Tour was 3 years of stadiums, and it's 2 hours of music, and there's like four hits. And the whole thing just straight through was fantastic and was beloved. And I think maybe you're right. Maybe I am underestimating it. And people know Writing to Stand Still, and they know these songs. And the way they'll mix it in with the video content will make it all, it'll be fantastic. And I think it'll work straight through. I just think they're going to get cold feet. I think often they plan these things and they get cold feet. They planned on doing two separate shows for the last tour. They got cold feet. They rehearsed Drowning Man, you know, for 360, and then they got cold feet. So I worry when they go into production rehearsals, they'll be like, "Well, how about if we play Pride in the center of it?" You know,
you can totally see that. So,
yeah. Or the idea, you know, God, do we play it backwards? You know, but then you start with Mothers of the Disappeared. Yeah. It's just Streets has always been the center of, you know, a thing they build to, though they did start with it obviously on the Joshua Tree tour.
And that's where I think, like, from a fan perspective, it feels like give the fans a little bit of credit, like from the band, like I'm saying to the band, because, mm-hmm. you know, we being, you know, those of us who were there and when the Joshua Tree first came around, we're fine with it being opening like that. And like you said, it's a short tour. Have a little bit of fun. Let your hair down, so to speak, and put Streets right at the top. And then work your way back from that and figure out how, as this amazing band who puts on an amazing live show, you're going to do this and pull this off, right? Like, because I guess I'd be err on the side of being like, let's play the album all the way through and figure out how do we do that? What do we do before, after? How is that going to fit into a 2-hour show when the album's an hour or whatever? What do we do then? But yeah, like take advantage of the fact, like you said, that it's a short tour, experiment a little bit. You've sold out the tour. Like people are not going to go away mad if you play Joshua Tree.
Yeah. I think a smart move is maybe to go like chronological. Start with Out of Control or I Will Follow, you know, play Sunday Bloody Sunday or whatever, maybe Pride, then do the album, and then afterwards do 90s stuff. You know, they can maybe just go straight chronological. They can tell the whole story of the band in sequence.
Right.
You know, it's a very different band, but I've seen the Monkees do that, where it's just chronological, and it's very effective. You know, the encores are a bit rough, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I see. There's tons and tons of discussion about what the set list might look like in our forum. And somebody a few days ago posted what I thought was a really interesting idea. And it's along the lines of what you were just saying, Andy, where, you know, do maybe, you know, 7 or 8 songs at the start, you know, that are hits that are, you know, the early 80s stuff. Maybe mix in some, I think the person was suggesting maybe put Beautiful Day in there, you know, something that, you know, that the casual fan knows. My dream, and this goes back to the Elevation tour, my dream is that they will do, you know, this group of hits at the beginning, then they'll play Bad, and then Bad will segue into Streets, because that was so brilliant on the Elevation tour. I want to see that again.
Oh, yeah.
Right, like how amazing was that on the Boston?
I just
watched that 2-song segue from the Elevation, the Boston Elevation DVD. I watched that on a consistent, and it always blows my mind and gets me all emotional. So selfishly, that's what I want them to do: play the album in full, and then I'm with you. Play play some a few more songs afterwards from whatever time period.
Yeah. Then do they do any sort of intermission? Do you do it in the midway point of the album at a point that it'll be flipped over if it was vinyl? And then you do it, it's hard to say. I imagine a great deal the rest of the set is going to be hits because there's so many obscurities on the Joshua Tree, which is what Edge said to me, was that, you know, there'd be so many deep cuts we're going to play that there probably is not going to be room for other deep cuts. So my dream of a drowning man will have to wait, I think.
So, yeah, and, or, you know, although there's so many good B-sides from the Joshua Tree era, and I just don't see those things getting into the set list.
No, I think it's just not going to happen.
They might have one slot where they, like you said, they, you know, they insert obscure song here and just do even a snippet of it or whatever, but
yeah,
the full band treatment doesn't get done necessarily. Give Larry a break.
No.
I know very little about Bonnaroo. So how does this fit in with, you know, U2 doesn't do festivals very much, and how do they fit this Joshua Tree tour into this existing festival, this 3-night kind of thing?
I think it'll be like Glastonbury. I think, though, somewhat easier because that was the middle of 350 when they had this crazy stage. I think the stage would be more bare than before, but I think that they're going to have to just get them on a regular big stage without all the bells and whistles. And there may be a time when they don't do Joshua Tree straight through. I forget if it's even billed as such. It depends on how much time they get. You know, I bet they'll get like a 2.5-hour block.
Really? Okay.
And when Springsteen played Bonnaroo, it was in his contract, I think, or it was definitely enforced that no other bands played what he was playing. So all their stages were totally empty. So he had the biggest possible crowd, and there's all their background noise. So it could be a very great moment, a real moment of triumph. They may be tempted to play a more hits focused set there. Like when Neil Young was doing his Greendale tour, when he played Bonnaroo, he did not do Greendale. You know, so it's not uncommon to sort of to switch it up. But they can't bring all their screens and stuff. You know, it's just going to be a different thing. It'll be like Glastonbury.
Right. Yeah. That kind of was what I was wondering about, like how much of the normal production can they do in, you know, inside of an existing 3-day festival?
Yeah, well, when Kanye tried to do his Glow in the Dark tour at Bonnaroo, it took so many hours to get set up because Pearl Jam played late that the sun was rising when he went on stage. So, which is crazy because the whole thing was based on being in the dark. So if they get too ambitious, it's just going to take too long, and they don't have time. It's the previous band is done, maybe half an hour passes, an hour passes, and then they play. So they got to pare it down.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't think they'll do this, but it seems like it would be an awesome place if you think of U2 back in the late 80s, where they would have done, you know, a bit of maybe a political angle to the set list, but it would have been like, this is us, and we're trying to get our message across, and not as worried about the hits necessarily. Whereas now it feels like, you know, there's the legacy and the whatever to think about and not wanting to tick off a bunch of folks who are in this party atmosphere.
And they're not playing to their audience. It'll be a lot of people that don't really know them, that are much younger, that may not even like them. So I think they're going to have to really win them over, which will be a good challenge. It's because they're used to, no matter what happens with the reception to the album, when they walk on stage, they're playing to their fans, and it's really soothing to them. This will be a very different thing.
Yeah, and with the set list we were talking about earlier and sort of a bit of the politics, not to get too deep into that, but they definitely haven't shied away from criticism of the current U.S. president, and maybe I can ask this as the token Canadian in the conversation where I'm not as loaded one way or the other, but do you sense that they'll tone it down when it comes to the actual stage, you know, when they're actually on tour and not... Because, you know, we've seen, I know Matt's mentioned, from within the forums and stuff, a lot of sort of fans on the conservative side a little bit more worried about how are we just going to go get blasted because we voted for Trump or whatever. And like, and how do you think, what's your sense, I guess, from the conversations you've had with the band over that kind of stuff?
You know, it's a very interesting period that, you know, they liked Bill Clinton. They wouldn't, Bono worked with him. Even Bush, at the peak of the war and everything, Bono was working with him and was very hesitant to bash him because he would lose access. He would, you know, they were working together on debt relief and whatnot. And Obama, too. So it's uncharted territory with a president that has no possibility of working with Bono or caring about his issues. I think he's going to try and be careful, but I think the bullet rap will be intense. And I think the message will be that America is better, that it's better than this, that your values are values that are shared by the whole world. You set the stage for so many things, and you were better than this man, I think, will be somewhat of the tone. I think he will praise America while bashing Trump, is my
right.
guess.
Go more the individual as opposed to any sort of political or party, I guess, attack, yes, or right, left, or whatever kind of angle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. As I don't know if you're invited or you're going to the tour opener in Vancouver, but just that's where I'm going to be. And again, coming where they have set this up as a bit of like, because of Trump, because of what's going on in Britain and whatever, all this stuff, but opening the show in Canada, which is probably for business reasons and taxes or whatever, but how they'll set that, you know, they're obviously trying to, they'll practice, or whether they see it as a practice or not, but like before they get come down to the States, doing it in Canada where the Canadian crowd won't be as interested in, we're very aware obviously of what goes on in the US, but it's not our air quotes problem, so to speak. So how, you know, receptive the audience is to some sort of bullet rant that's, yeah, anyways, it'll be interesting, I guess, to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, I'm very curious.
Because this is the second straight tour, right, that the opening night is in Vancouver. Andy, do you have any, like, are there business reasons for that?
I know the Stones launch every day. They always rehearse there. I think you set up shop there because to get the tour launched takes a long time, and you set up shop there with your managers and everything for a matter of weeks. And I think there's definitely tax reasons and business reasons why that's advantageous. And there's venues there. I think it's really also a stadium that they could use for like 2 weeks or something to have to test the stage and stuff. But there's definitely, it's the same reason why movies film in Vancouver and pretend that it's America. You know, there's just tax incentives that I don't fully understand, but are definitely there.
Okay.
Plus there's Tim Hortons, so.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Edge is a huge Tim Hortons fan from what we've
heard. Yeah.
So, Andy, back, like, I mean, you know, as a journalist, you know how this used to work. You know, you two would announce a tour, everything would be coordinated. You know, this month we're going to be on the Rolling Stone cover, next month we're going to be on the Q Magazine cover, you know, then we're going to be, you know, NBC, you know, CBS, MTV. And there's just this whole, you know, this whole sort of scheduling and, you know, this campaign kind of thing. Does that still go on? I get the sense that it's all different now because, you know, here you had these three very popular interviews that hit the web before they went in the magazine. I don't think it's the cover of the current Rolling Stone, right? It's just, it's inside is where it's featured. So how has the promotion changed for this kind of thing?
Well, I think that this is a unique animal and it's just a tour. When there's a new album being sold, it's a different deal usually because this tour is sold out. So as I think it's sold out, so their incentive to go push it hard is sort of reduced. And if they do a huge press push now, that will minimize the impact of the push for the next album, which is the thing that they really want to sell. So I think they're going to hold their fire. They're going to hold back Bono. And they don't want to sort of waste a big opportunity to get lots of press now. So I think they sort of did the minimal stuff they can do. And then when it's time for songs of experience, presuming that ever happens, that there'll be a lot more coverage and they'll do a whole push because they'll go on Fallon, you know, they'll do the whole deal.
Right. So you're right. So if they did this big full on assault now, they'd be less likely to get the same level of coverage.
Yeah. That you know, only have so many opportunities at covers and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, they want Jimmy Fallon weak. You know, they have the biggest impact because there's a finite number of seats at concerts, obviously, but there's no limit to the amount of records you can sell. So, you know, they want to keep their powder dry for the album, is my guess.
And they've sort of alluded to and hinted at, and this is maybe, like you said, some of the Bono, filibustering, where the way the new album is going to come out is, you know, is going to be amazing and life-changing to all of us or something. But in your conversation with Adam, he seemed resigned almost to having a hit on the radio. Do you think the band's measures success based on radio airplay still, or is that not really a focus of modern
promotion? I think there's differences in the band, but I think they still believe, maybe to their own detriment, that they can have A Beautiful Day Again. They can have a Vertigo.
Right.
And those came out, you know, it may feel recent to them, but those were a long time ago, and the industry has changed so much. And some of my least favorite songs are Sexy Boots and these songs where they tried to get radio play from. So I think the odds of a rock band in their mid-50s having a radio hit is virtually zero at this point. And if you chase that, you wind up pleasing nobody. The hardcore fans don't like the song that you're made for the radio, and the casual fans, they don't even hear it. So I sort of wish sometimes they'd be more like Depeche Mode or something, and just sort of make the album and not really overthink everything and not worry too much about having a radio hit, and recognizing that we have our fans, we can always tour, we can still sell a ton of records, but our era in the sun, our era having hits, is probably over, and just sort of accept that.
And if anybody doubted Andy's fan card, there it is right there, because I think the vast majority of our listeners and readers would feel the same way as you. Yeah, it seems so unlikely in this era. And a lot of fans say, you know, look at what is on the charts. Why would you want to be in with that, you know, with that garbage, right?
And they shattered the record from I Will Follow to Vertigo. Was what, that was 26 years or something? The Stones had what, 15 years of scoring hits from Satisfaction to Start Me Up or something? I mean, they broke the record. They are in the Hall of Fame 10 times over for all that. That, you know, it's a weird comparison, but I've interviewed John Mellencamp a lot, and he told me that when his hit stopped in the 90s, he was angry all the time and he kept trying. It was just full of frustration. He was miserable. Then in the 2000s, he just gave up, and he made albums for himself. And he said that it got better, and his life got better, and his stress went away. There's times you have to just stop fighting and just sort of just try and make great art and realize that everybody has their moment in the sun, and it ends. But that doesn't mean you're dead. It just means that you're not going to be on the radio in the same station as Justin Bieber in The Weeknd. You know, it's impossible.
Let's before we wrap up, let's tackle a couple other fan issues. Is that okay, Chris? Do we have time?
Oh yeah.
As long as because that right there, you know, this idea of going after the radio hit, that is always a hot topic. Let's hit on a couple other things. Andy, the length of a U2 concert, they usually play what, 2 hours, 15 minutes, somewhere in there. And yet, you know, fans will say, why can't they play as long as Bruce Springsteen or Pearl Jam or whoever?
Yeah. Well, Bruce is a freak of nature that he can.
Isn't he? Right.
I think that's the result of a personal trainer and not having sugar or fat since like the 80s. And, you know, and just being insane. I think U2, they have to pace themselves. And I think that Bono would like have a heart attack on stage if they played 4 hours. And I just think that's not feasible. So, you know, I'd always like a show to be longer. I just don't think that's in the cards.
What about the set lists during? We kind of touched on this a little bit about, you know, what they should play, that sort of stuff. But what about the idea that it doesn't change enough over the course of a tour?
Yeah, I think that's a problem. I think often to the band, the story of the concert tells a story, but it's kind of a thread that only Bono understands and is following. So he thinks, oh, it's crucial, this follows this, that follows this, and follows this, then the lights turn red, and that means this. And I think they spend too much time thinking about this, the themes and messages, when no one really cares about that stuff. So I think they're also, that they're so tied to these lighting cues and video cues that it's hard to change it up on the A stage. I would love to see that set list change a lot. I wish they'd be more flexible with that.
Was it you, like, I can't remember who it was that was on tour, like, within the last, I don't know, year or two or three, but I could swear that you started tweeting about, I don't know if it was like Neil Young or Bob Dylan or something like that. It was somebody that like hadn't changed their set list in like years or something like that. Does that ring a bell?
Was that Neil Young in like 2015 when he was doing so many Rare songs constantly?
Okay. Was that it?
Well, I'm not sure what exactly you're referring to.
Well, I just remember you sending out a tweet about, you know, one of these, you know.
Oh, it was Bob Dylan. Yes. Yeah. Bob Dylan had the set that didn't change for many years and the fans were going completely insane.
So we have it pretty good relative to Dylan fans, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But the Dylan fans have been tortured for a long time. Yeah, because half the set was covers. It was these weird Sinatra songs that he was doing. Okay. And it was really getting torturous.
Don't tempt Bono. He probably wants to.
Exactly. Yeah.
There is, I would say there is the hardcore. There is, I know from joining at U2 and seeing, getting a peek into some of the fans' passion over the set list and figuring out the story and all that kind of stuff, like you alluded to. I guess I'll step in as defense for them a little bit. Not that I agree with you, though, that majority of fans don't really care why Bolt the Blue Sky is after that song, and they just want, right, you know, a good experience that night, and don't get the whole like spiritual line through the whole thing from start to finish, and Heart of Darkness in the middle and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's an interesting dilemma that I think I would love to, I wish they would invite you along. I wish they'd invite me along, but I wish they invite Rolling Stone along to some of that process of the set list decisions and stuff. Because I mean, there's only so many more tours they're going to be doing, and and to have another book like Flanagan's book, you know, walking us through some of that stuff, or even a few, would be awesome, I think. But
yeah, I think the key thing to remember is the show's meant to be seen once. And the freaks like us that go over and over and over again are not what they're really thinking about a lot of the time.
Yeah. They're aware we're there, but they're not catering to us per se.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
That's fair, yeah.
Andy, how many Joshua Tree shows are you going to see?
At least four.
And when you go, you are going to Vancouver. It'd be great if we get a chance to say hello in person. That'd be awesome.
Yeah,
when you go to these shows, you're there as press, I would assume, or at least some of them. Like, do you have to stay with like up in the press box, or are you down on the floor, or like how does that all work?
They give us seats. They give us really good seats if we are reviewing the show or just going. So I usually get two tickets for the shows, and they're usually pretty good. It's a very nice perk in the job. And then when they play the Garden or something, they have a whole pre-show room where you go with a bunch of people. I mean, I have a sort of funny story, right? So I go to the 8th show, and I'm with a bunch of my coworkers, and they give us passes to this pre-show area. It's just some big room with like appetizers and free booze and stuff. And I'm back there, and their publicist taps me on the shoulder, and it's like the band wants to like see you, and I'm like okay. You know, because basically by that point, I'd written maybe 30 articles about the tour. Just every morning when they'd bring out kids to sing with them or something, I would do a post about it. I kept interviewing them. So I'm taken backstage and I'm walking past all these areas full of VIPs. You see, like, there's one VIP room, there's a smaller one, and it's this whole crazy world. And they take me, I'm outside the band's dressing rooms, and there's security there, and they told me to just wait there. And I guess inside were Bruce Springsteen and the Clintons were talking to the band. So I'm just standing there. I'm waiting to be brought in. And the show's going to start soon. It's supposed to start in like 5 minutes. And I'm, you know, really anxious to get to my seat because I can't miss the opening song. You know, I'm crazy. And I was in the bowels of the Garden. I didn't know where I was. So I kept saying to the publicist and the security guard, I'm like, look, Do you mind if I just go to my seat? This is not a interview. I don't want to, you know, like to keep waiting and then miss the show. And they say the show can't start until they walk out, and they're in here. So you keep waiting. I'm like, okay. Like 10 minutes pass. I'm standing there. The show's starting late, and I'm like, guys, like Bill Clinton is in there. He will never stop talking. Okay, so you know, but and they keep saying no, you know, you keep waiting, they have to see you, and I'm like, okay, but you know, I don't need to talk to them. This is not for a story. And then eventually I just say, look, guys, I gotta go, you know. So I left. I just, the thought of them walking the stage and just saying hello, and then them watching the show, and then me being God knows where, like 10 decks, you know, below, I was just going crazy. So I blew them off, and I go to my seat, and the show starts. And then, like, 2 weeks later, I get a package from France. And I opened up, there's this huge letter from Bono where he's like, Andy, we wanted to see you backstage. We're sorry that we missed you, blah, blah, blah. And he drew a picture of himself on it and everything. So I think it was better to, you know, cause just to meet them is no big deal again, but this huge letter, you know, I framed it. So
Andy, that's Green, awesome. The guy that blew you two off.
Well, I would have waited for hours for anything else, but I just couldn't miss the show starting. Because I figured, look, this is the eighth night, that they would open with something else. And
that is fantastic.
I can't tell if that's proof of your, if that's like a further point for your U2 fandom card or a dock because you missed the chance to, but I guess you get to talk to them other times.
So. I was with them in Vancouver. So yeah. I'd already talked to them, and I'm a believer that if I'm talking to a rock star, but I'm not taping it, then it's just a waste of time. You know, I want to interview them.
Yeah.
And if it's just social, and I also knew that after that, they'd have to run to the stage. So it would be 1 second, you know, because the show.
Chris, I have it, Chris. We'll dock him 5 points for blowing off you two, but we'll give him 500 points for getting a letter and package from them a couple weeks later.
Yes.
Exactly.
It was on a stationary. It was very cool. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a great spot to wrap up on that story. And we really appreciate you coming on the podcast, Andy. And
Thank you, Andy. Look forward to
hopefully catching up with you in Vancouver and reading, I guess, your reviews of the show and your assessment of the balance of new and old songs in the set list.
I can't wait. And there's still a chance for Acrobat. I can feel it. There's a slight chance for Acrobat, and it'll be my proudest moment.
Is that, can we, speaking of U2 fandom, one last question, I guess. Are you on the Acrobat side or the Drowning Man side of those two? Which, if you had to pick one, is Acrobat?
I'd rather hear Acrobat.
Okay. Well, there you go. We got that on record now. So
yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Andy, again. And
great.
Talk to you again.
Yeah, of course. That was fun. So thank you, guys.
Thanks, Andy.
All right. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. Andy actually sent us pictures of the letter he got from Bono. So if you want to check that out, visit goodstuff.fm/ATU2/50. We'll have the photos there for you. See you next time.